This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX, and I'm Jennifer Wing, your guide this hour, and we're exploring the ties that bind us together. One thing we can all relate to is our connection to family. And for Margaret Bullitt, her family, it's a Seattle institution. They originally made their money in timber and helped create the civic backbone of Seattle. Children's Hospital, the Seattle Symphony, Cornish College, the King Broadcasting Empire. Margaret's mother, Kay Bullitt, founded a credit union to help empower women. She worked to desegregate Seattle's schools. And coming from a family filled with people who were out to leave a mark on this city, it was intimidating. Margaret felt a lot of pressure.
And this idea that you have to do for others and be good in the community, and if you aren't always doing for others and, you know, good in the community, then somehow there's something suspect.
In her early 20s, Margaret was living in New York. She was trying to make it as an actor. Even as a graduate from Yale, she felt like a failure compared to her relatives. And the way she dealt with this was to bottle everything up. And in a way, this made her really vulnerable and open to connecting with a group called Direct Centering.
It attracted me because I thought it was going to cure me of my emotions in a way, because the emotions I didn't want. I didn't want to feel afraid. I didn't want to feel afraid. I didn't want to feel afraid. That was the main thing. And I think I felt so afraid of life, trying to be an actress in New York. So I hoped that I would go and it would just cleanse me of all that, and then I would be able to march into an audition and be my best self.
Direct Centering sold itself as a sort of new agey self-help seminar, but really it was a cult led by a man named Bayard Hora.
He was a strange looking man. He was bald and had wide set eyes and a gap between his two front teeth and a very wide smile, and you know, so when he would open his jaw, it was a little snake-like. And then he was slender, and he was wearing a velour sports suit, and he had slip-on sandals, and I could see that he had six toes on each foot, and they were kind of gnarled, and so they looked claw-like. And so on a visceral level, I was really recoiling inside by this bird of prey, you know, snake-like appearance. You know, he was walking around, talking, leading one of these seminars, and all the staff members were around the edges of the room, and they were applauding and laughing and, you know, obviously really into him. And I was thinking, this is so weird, and he's very strange, and I liked them better than I liked him. But then when I went out into the hall during the break, he approached me and said, "So you're Margaret." He'd heard about me because I'd been there the weekend before when he wasn't there, and I'd signed up for all these classes. So I think he'd heard about how willing I was to pull out my checkbook. Well, so then he said, "I love you," and he kissed me on the cheek, and then he said, "You're such a dip." He kissed me on the other cheek, and then he repeated it. And I stood there and I was really dumbfounded because I thought, this is so bizarre. This is very contrary. And so my mind and my gut and my heart, you know, they're all just working overtime, you know, like at this moment. And then there was something in me that said, this feels very familiar. This is where I belong. And so I decided I would sign up for more.
All of these emotions are going on. And that was the final say, was, okay, these are my people.
Yeah, it was an odd sense of belonging. Yeah.
And for someone, as you described yourself as being so afraid, mm-hmm. it must have been very comforting to have that feeling in such a large city trying to do what you were doing.
It was, because it meant that a lot of the questions in my life, I didn't need to ask them anymore. Pretty soon I moved out of a beautiful apartment on Park Avenue where I had been living, and I moved into kind of marginal communal housing. I didn't go to auditions anymore. I didn't go to acting classes anymore. I didn't go to church anymore. I didn't see friends anymore. I mean, within a short time, I kind of cleared out my schedule. And it meant that, you know, love and work, those two things that were, and are for most people, the big questions, they were taken off the table in a way, because if I just did what I was told, it made life quite simple. And they also were very strict about food, and I had been struggling with overeating. And so when I heard that they ascribed to the Fit for Life diet, eating only fruit in the morning and so on, that just really appealed to me because I thought, great, there's going to be this external control. And so I just think I was looking for external control because I felt out of control.
And relationships within direct centering, how did that work? What were you expected to do with other members in terms of sexual relationships?
Well, it was suggested there were, I think, one or two, you know, nice enough guys, but just not attractive to me, who I was encouraged to be with. And I had the idea that I was bad for not being more willing, because I thought if I were truly grounded, truly centered, truly loving, I could love anyone. That my attachment to looks or to wanting a certain kind of person was something that I was ashamed of. Eventually, I was promoted to being Bayard Hora's personal assistant, and I was supposed to go down to the Florida Keys where he lived, and this was supposed to happen right after Easter. So I'd been there since September, and so I told my mother, I'm going to go to the Florida Keys, and she had been noticing that my tone of voice was flattening, and I had less of a sense of humor, and I was just always beating the drum that I wanted her to come from Seattle to New York to do this course in direct centering. My mother never signed up, but she got concerned about me, and she contacted a cult organization because she suspected this might be a cult. And she was told, yes, direct centering is known to be a cult. And then she was told, if Margaret goes to be with this man, she's probably going to become sexually involved with him, and you probably will lose her.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect, and the theme this week is The Ties That Bind. We're talking with Margaret Bullitt, who fell into a cult called direct centering when she was in her 20s while living in New York City. And again, at this point in the story, Margaret's mother, Kay, who was back in Seattle, knows that direct centering is a cult, and she's trying to save her daughter. And Margaret, she knows that her mother is suspicious, and Margaret makes deliberate efforts to prove to her mother that she's fine and that everything's okay.
I told her that I was going to spend Easter weekend with a college friend of mine down in Princeton. And I was, again, proud of that because that seemed like a very normal thing to do. And I was proud that I was having this job and that I was doing these normal things because I knew she thought I was in a cult. And so I would tell her these things that I thought proved that I was still normal. But deep down, I was thinking, yuck, I'm crazy. You know, like, this is such a crazy life I'm living. But anyway, my mother had, unbeknownst to me, did set up a deprogramming.
So you know you're in a cult, even though you don't want to admit it. Mm-hmm. Your mom has the alarm bells going off for her. And she figures out, yes, this is a cult. I need to reach my daughter before it's too late. Mm-hmm. And she planned an intervention.
Yes.
How did that go?
Well, I mentioned to my mother that I was going to be spending Easter weekend with my friend. So she contacted my friend. And so I went down ostensibly to spend the weekend with her. And then as I was, you know, chatting in her living room, again, trying to appear very carefree and as if everything was fine in my life, then the phone rang and she came out and said, your mom's on the phone. And I said, my mother. And she said, yeah, she's in town. She's in Princeton. I said, she's in Princeton. That's a long way to come. Like, did she take a wrong turn on her way to the QFC? And I said, oh, she just thinks I'm in a cult. And they looked, like, no response, you know, just say, oh. She came, picked me up, and we went to this hotel where my mother was staying in Princeton. And my mother said, when we got there, I have a present for you, but it's up in my hotel room. And do you mind if we go get it? So I went with her, and she did have a present in her room. She handed it to me, and then I saw that over her shoulder, I could see there were several people in the room, and it was my half-sister and then two strangers, two men. And as soon as I saw this assembled group, I knew it was a deprogramming or an intervention. It is considered a controlling move, and to do an intervention. I mean, some people don't consider it a positive thing, of course. They think that it's kind of jumping from the frying pan into the fire, because I was convinced at direct centering that my family had programmed me. And so I was very worried that if my family deprogrammed me, it would be to get me back.
That whole idea of you viewing your going to direct centering as a deprogramming of your family, and then worried about mm-hmm. an intervention on the part of your family coming to mm-hmm. take you from direct centering. Did you view your family as some sort of a cult?
I was worried that the people at direct centering were right about that, that I had been indoctrinated. I don't know that I thought of it as a cult, although maybe a little bit, because my father, you know, I think in our family, we all tried to please him. And yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that even now. Yeah.
In what way?
Well, just a charismatic leader.
Your dad.
My dad. And he had a quality that made people really want to see him be happy and delighted. And then he would withdraw emotionally. And so that's the control. You know, he could just kind of turn on and turn off. And that was, for me, was really unbearable to see him turn off.
Back in that hotel room,
mm-hmm.
all this is going through your mind.
Mm-hmm. And my father wasn't there. And that hurt me. I felt really disappointed that he and my sister Dorothy weren't part of it. But I think they were afraid that it wouldn't work, that I would be so angry that I would cut off forever. But I decided to stay. And my mother was very quiet most of the time. She later told me there was the risk that she would lose me by doing this intervention, but she felt that she'd lost me anyway.
How long did it take you to remove yourself from direct centering?
Within a few hours, I knew I didn't want to go back. But I, as I said, I was still afraid of going back to my family, and I didn't know where do I go. I was surprised that it wasn't over the first night. The exit counselor or the deprogrammer said, oh, no, you're not done. I mean, he told my mother she needs another week of deprogramming here at this hotel. And then from there, the exit counselor recommended that I go to a halfway house. So I went to Iowa to this house where people from the Moonies and a fundamentalist Baptist group and the Hare Krishna. It was called Unbound, and it was a nonprofit meant to help people out of situations where they had been under mind control.
Direct centering never tried to track Margaret down to pull her back in, and she credits her mother for helping her finally escape the bizarre life she led there. The relationship was still difficult, but Margaret says there was a moment on their way back to Seattle, sitting on a train, where she felt so full-hearted.
And I was able to, you know, I just remember tears coming down my cheeks, and I just said, thank you. And she had never demanded any kind of thanks, and she'd never said anything about what I'd put her through.
Since leaving direct centering, things haven't always been easy for Margaret. She's struggled with being drawn to other organizations that sell a certain belief or a way of life. It's just been in the last few years that she's really made peace with herself and with her mom, who's now in her 90s.
Just since turning 50, I finally got the memo that really it's accepting not only other people, but myself. And that was the hardest journey, or the hardest thing for me to learn, was to accept myself. And once I was able to do that, I was able to accept my mother.
What has your mother said in response to this this memo that you have received?
Well, you know, I think that she is just happy to have a relationship with me, but she doesn't talk about it, you know, because there was such friction, you know, when I was always struggling to change her. But I think she was so much stronger than I realized. I always thought of her as weak, but I came to realize how weak I was.
That's Margaret Bullitt talking about her experience of being involved with a cult and how her mother saved her. Margaret is currently writing a memoir.